You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul Bloom.
Hello, Robert Wright. How you doing?
I'm just wonderful. Let me introduce this, Paul. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero newsletter, to which everyone should subscribe. This is a Non-Zero podcast. You're Paul Bloom, world-famous psychologist, publisher and author of the world-famous Small Potatoes newsletter, author of literally volumes of AI training data. But then again, who among us isn't?
Renaissance man, bon vivant.
And also bon vivant. It's been a while since I called you that, but you really are.
The vivant here is very bon. It's working out.
See, that's what I mean. I couldn't have said that because I don't know what either of those words actually mean.
Well, I've been sitting in my house for the last few weeks just working away. You have been to Doha.
I was in Doha, Qatar. Yes.
And all I want to ask you is, how was the food?
Well, first of all, the good news, Israel did not bomb Qatar while I was there. I was 4 miles away from the site they did bomb. So if they'd done a repeat bombing, they wouldn't have killed me. I was there, and it's a great place. It's recently built place until, you know, the country's only, I think 1971 is kind of the year of its birth or its independence. And, it's hopping, I'll tell you. A cosmopolitan place. You know, it really is. I mean, it's very vibrant and very nice. And, you know, you feel safe and it's great. You should go.
How was the food?
Food was great. I mean, I was staying at a really nice hotel. The reason is because I wasn't paying for it. But I'll tell you, it's not very expensive. This is a hotel that would have cost twice as much in Manhattan.
Okay.
And the food is, everything's reasonable. It's great.
What kind of food is it? Is it like European food or is it like Middle Eastern or what do you?
You can get anything there, especially the part of town I was staying in. But if you go to like the souk where we hung out a lot, the old market, much of which is reconstructed because it burned down. But the place where the original kind of town market was, much of which is outdoors. It's mainly Middle Eastern food there. But in the kind of swanky hotel section, you know, you can get any kind of food. And there's some very, very good food there.
Very nice. Very nice. And they flew you there for a conference?
No, the official guidance is don't say anything about this on social media until the thing airs. But I assume I can say it was under the Doha Debates brand, and it's a conversation about AI.
And were you debating people about AI?
It was a round table, but yeah, there was differences of opinion that we didn't conceal. And, it'll be on YouTube, both in full form and then they'll edit it down to 48 minutes and that'll air on Al Jazeera English.
So I look forward to checking it out.
Me too. Actually, no, I don't want to watch. I don't watch these except for your half of the screen. I love watching you. So anyway, Paul,
I went through Larry Summers. There's been a big Epstein drop. And as big far Epstein. As I know, your name was not mentioned.
So far, so good.
Nor was mine. We both, that was a relief.
Yeah. I mean, I'll tell you, I'm sweating bullets because any moment now, the truth is going to come out. But so far, I've dodged the bullets.
Is he one of the founders of the Non-Zero Foundation?
You know, you got to get your money from somewhere. And look, what money is clean? Paul, really, is there clean money? No. So I just figured Les Wexner, Jeff Epstein, whatever. We all need money. So, I know that's, of course. Okay, let's get to the news. Before we get to the fact that your friend Larry Summers is in trouble over Epstein, let's get to, let's just summarize. So, first of all, there was a documents dump. These had come, I gather, from the Epstein estate, actually. These are not from the Trump administration's files, But those now are the files are supposedly going to be released in within 30 days. There was this congressional vote.
The whole thing unredacted.
Oh, I gotta think it's going to be redacted.
I think it should be redacted. There's a lot of
here's the problem. There are things that should be redacted. Unfortunately, we have no way of knowing whether they've gone beyond that in their redaction. And they will, of course.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, I'd love to see the totally unredacted version. But look, let me tell you something that's already come out. This was a pretty big documents dump. And I come, the one that's already out. And I came across this thing today about how Epstein was in touch with Steve Bannon. Have you read up on that?
A little bit, yeah.
Kind of interesting because, I mean, here's kind of the part that interests me. So Epstein, like, had a line into the Trump administration that was so robust that Steve Bannon, who you would think still had some connections to the administration, is relying on Epstein for almost real-time information, it sounds like. So, okay, so here's an exchange. Jeffrey Epstein, they're texting, I guess. DJT, Donald Trump, now really down on Pence, the vice president, that is, thinks Pompeo would be better VP. They're talking about a running mate, I guess. Says Pence not really loyal. Now, this is in 2019, not all that long before I think Epstein is indicted again, goes to jail and dies.
Yeah.
And then Epstein says, and yes, he did ask Kelly to get rid of Jared and then Jared to get rid of Kelly. Par for the course. And then Bannon says, how did you hear and why is he? And Epstein says something unresponsive and something else. But this does. Here's to me the most interesting exchange. Epstein says, now you can understand why Trump. First he tells him that. So according to this account, he appears to tell Steve Bannon that Donald Trump was aware of their ongoing political relationship, meaning Epstein and Bannon. And in the middle of an exchange about Israeli politics, Epstein wrote, now you can understand why Trump wakes up in the middle of the night sweating when he hears you and I are friends. And Bannon's reply is dangerous. That's what Bannon says. Now, if I were a conspiracy theorist, I would say this kind of underscores the fact that one can imagine reasons that Donald Trump would not have wanted Jeffrey Epstein to live a long and happy life. The Trump administration was in charge of the prison where he died. But, you know, I am not, as you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. So I would like to retract everything I just said.
A lot of people wanted Epstein dead. I just think this is an issue which I could be the most conspiratorial about. I could also imagine people wanted the guards to at least give Epstein the chance to kill himself and not to intervene. Actually killing him, I don't know. It's very parsimonious that Epstein simply wanted to die and that the prisons are run poorly.
Yeah, I mean, we talked in the past about the very convenient number of cameras that weren't operating.
Yeah.
And which cameras those turned out to be and how kind of almost tailor-made that was for shenanigans. But yeah, I don't know. I'm agnostic. And frankly, you know, there are reasons to doubt that it happened. And I don't know. But this whole thing, I don't know what to make of.
I mean, you once convinced me of something.
Yeah.
More than once, but over this, which is, I've always thought Trump is bulletproof among his followers. That, you know, no matter what he does, and the celebrity apprentice, he says the N-word, whatever, they won't care. They don't care about the rape charges. They don't care about anything. Pedophilia or whatever this falls into may be the one exception, given how much the sexual exploitation of teenagers and children is at the core of the QAnon ideas and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So this could really, something here really could hurt him among the true believers.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I see that you're trying to postpone the moment where you have to confront the fact that your friend Larry Summers is in deep trouble. But we'll get to that. I do on this point. Yeah, I mean, somewhat separate from this, but related to it, are all these stories about a split within MAGA. I say somewhat separate from it because this isn't the only factor. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene embodies this split. She and Trump, last time I checked, are now more or less enemies, and she used to be called the Queen of MAGA. And there are really two main issues. There's this, and then there's, I would say, Israel, there's Israel. And that, in turn, is related to this whole Tucker thing that we talked about last time, which is not totally unrelated. But yeah, you're seeing all these things about split within MAGA.
Yeah.
You know, and I just looked at Trump's approval ratings for the first time in a while. They're bad. I used to think he had like this rock bottom floor of 45% approval, but the Real Clear Politics number is down to 43 for the first time, you know, until a few weeks ago, it had never, ever gotten down there, this administration.
So what's been happening? The shutdown hit him a little bit.
Yeah.
And then what is it, really Epstein?
I think people are said to be sensing that prices are rising, and he is, you know, like price of coffee. And so some prices are rising. The economy is not great. And he is so prominently identified with those tariffs. I mean, if prices rise, he just can't escape that. Yeah. It's just he is stuck because there was so much discussion. Yeah, I'm Mr. Tariff. And so much discussion of the fact that tariffs are going to, at least to some extent, increase prices that, you know, so he is actually making adjustments. He's starting to back off. And I think he's doing something about the tariff on coffee and so on. So he's backpedaling. But yeah, he's not in a good situation politically. So he can't really afford a deeper fissure within the MAGA coalition. And that's why at the last minute, he acted as if he was in support of this congressional vote. You know, hey, yeah, let's get these files out there. You're right.
A bit of mutually assured destruction. It's gonna hurt a few Democrats too, prominent Democrats.
Oh, it's gonna hurt all kinds of. And this, you know, one reason I am far from sure that there's some kind of smoking gun implicating Trump is that, look, everyone. Everyone in that realm, almost all American political elites probably have a friend or ally or associate who is going to come out of this, you know, not looking great, right? Because the establishment is ultimately not that huge a thing. It's like you and Larry Summers, right? It's like you guys are like...
It's not even Larry. Larry Summers is not the worst of it for me. For me, it's Chomsky, which is, I think Chomsky's intellectual contributions make him a figure of enormous importance, equivalent to Descartes, Plato, Hume, Locke,
Bob. Yeah.
But he may have had poor taste in friends. So, you know.
Wait, is Chomsky tied up in the Epstein thing?
Yeah. I mean, not for any sort of sexual malfeasance, but he has correspondence with Epstein talking about staying at his place in the Caribbean, staying at his place in New York. Epstein connected them to Woody Allen. They got together. The three of them got together for lunch. And then Chomsky wrote a rather glowing, seemed like a recommendation letter for Epstein. The context was unclear, but he said, this is a really smart guy and very creative and so on. So I don't know.
Good example.
There's an interesting question about charm. Epstein seemed to have a lot of friends and not schmoes and losers, really important people. Sometimes people of great accomplishment. And yeah, these people who like them. I don't know if it's as simple as Epstein was very rich and he could always just say, oh, here's $1 million to pursue your project. And that makes people very interested in associating with him. I mean, my boy Larry Summers was at one point said, you know, talking about, I think his wife wanted some support for a foundation. You know, Jeff, could you give her $1 million to help her out here? Having somebody who had that power to do things makes, maybe it's a key to popularity.
Did Epstein cough up the $1 million?
I don't think he did. I don't think he did. Mm. So let me ask you a question, which I want you to answer honestly. suppose your correspondence with your friends was opened up to the world, all mm-hmm. emails and all texts.
Mm-hmm.
How bad would that be for you?
Not bad at all.
Really?
Yeah. I think one reason is very early on in the email era, like right when I got an email account in the, I don't know, mid early 1990s, I read this thing written by someone who knew a lot about it. And it said, like, here's the way to think about email and communication in general. And the point was, you got to understand when you write an email.
Yeah.
Somebody can click forward and everyone in the world reads it.
Yeah.
And so they ranked like how careful you should be on in different communications media. And like phone call, you can be pretty, you know, you can let it all out, blah, blah, blah. Letter and like the thing you should be most careful about of all at that point, this is before texting and DMs, was email. So yeah. I think that's, oh, so many of my crimes I have not talked about in my correspondence, Paul, many of them.
You just like the face-to-face sort of. Phone calls.
Yeah. I mean, you know, because we've met person. So you know about the whole thing we're not going to talk about here. Yeah. But
it's the constant stream of sexism and racism that comes from you in these private conversations that just don't show up in emails. Which is very...
Yeah, you get a beer in me and fortunately, I don't drink. So we haven't done that experiment in decades.
There was a time fairly early on in my career at Yale where I got caught up in an investigation over data fraud. And as part of it, they went to everybody connected to it and said, we want your computers. We want to do a stamp of all of everything on your computers, including all your email.
Whoa.
We're not going to look into it unless it gets to a further stage, but we want to have the snapshot right now before we have time to mess with it. And including all the emails. And then I realized that you shouldn't write. The way we put it at Yale was you shouldn't write anything unless you're prepared to have it on the front page of Yale Daily News.
Exactly.
However, I've often forgot that. I think for me, the harm would come actually just at a sort of local level, which mm-hmm. is that I've said cruel things to be about people, which I would not want the people themselves to see. And mm-hmm. and but I just feel not everybody is as careful as you.
But see, part of it is that I'm not careful in my speech. I am much more inclined than you to say mean things about people I don't like, and even to like get all agitated and say more than I should say on podcasts and stuff. I'm just saying my emails aren't worse than that.
Yeah.
And that's pretty bad. The podcast, Bob, is pretty bad, but the emails aren't much worse than that.
I guess this brings me to Larry Summers. So Larry Summers had a correspondence with Epstein where they talked about, this is the one that got the most affection.
But first, the news flash, Larry is stepping, he's not even going to finish teaching the course he's teaching at Harvard this semester. He's stepping back, I assume with the encouragement of the university, but he's paying his penance. He's saying, I'm ashamed and I'm going to stay out of the public light until I've, you know, made amends or something. So anyway, that was this week's news, is that he is rending his garments, as he should. I think, but go ahead.
The biggest shock is he's a very esteemed professor at Harvard. And this semester, he's teaching two undergraduate courses and a graduate seminar. I'm thinking, that's an awfully high teaching load.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
he's a smart guy. He's very smart. He was Treasury Secretary. He was president of Harvard.
No, smart guy doesn't have a teaching load of three courses in one semester. And I think one course in another semester. Teaching too much. Nobody wants
not anymore. Not anymore. We solved that problem.
You think this is the sort of conspiratorial notion, which is this is all set up to reduce his teaching load.
This is just his way of reducing his teaching load. He's a very far-seeing person.
That's right. He set the seeds for it. Anyway, so he's there talking to Epstein about his romantic interest in somebody. Now, if you read the sort of secondhand reporting, you'd really get the feeling he's sort of preying on an undergraduate. Or somebody, they're very vague about it. And so the Harvard Crimson has a more detailed story. And the woman whose affections that he is interested in is a full professor at the London School of Economics in her mid-40s. So now, Summers is married, but I don't know, and you don't know, nobody knows, whether he and his wife have an open relationship, whether monogamous, whatever. So you could say, well, you shouldn't be seeking out other women's attention. I don't know. I guess parts of his discussions with Epstein seem a bit tasteless. But I think it's not a crime. It doesn't violate any academic rules at Harvard or anywhere else to be interested in a woman who's not your wife. And
I don't think that's the issue, though.
The issue is the issue.
I mean, we know of tons of people who have been interested in women who aren't their wife, and they're still teaching and didn't have to rend their garment.
The interest is he talked to Epstein about it.
Yeah, he was. Here's the way I would put it. And I don't really have a position on I don't know whether he should be compelled to step in. I do think this is a deeply embarrassing and a borderline shameful thing. But here's the way I would kind of put the reason. So the exchange with Epstein, it's like Epstein is his dating coach. Yeah. It's like one of those, it's like, you know, those books, what is it called? The Game or something. You know, when there was all that publicity about those How to Pick Up Women books, and there turned out to be this whole subculture. And this
I've
is where the word neg comes
from. Things.
What's that?
I've never needed to reference any of these things.
Well, you're special.
Yeah.
But some men have had to resort to this tactical guidance, and they learned that if you neg women, if you say, what's wrong with your hair? That's a tactical advantage, and blah, blah, blah. This was that kind of conversation, okay? Nothing wrong with that necessarily. But it's like at one point, Epstein says, you know, Summer says, well, so I think she's seeing this other guy. So here's what I said to her about that. And Epstein says, oh, that's good. Because it shows on the one hand, you care, but you don't seem insecure. So you look strong, but caring. That's perfect. And here's what I would say about that. Like, I have to look way back to remember when I was on the dating market, as we used to coldly refer to it, like decades. And so I don't remember a lot of specific conversations like this, but I think I can say one thing for sure. A, I probably had them. And B, I would only have them with really super close friends. I'm sure it would have had to be like a college buddy. It's not like I was turning to the guy in the cube, you know, office next to me and saying, you know, what do you think? So what I would say is, first of all, it's almost pathetic. There's a kind of pathetic aspect to it. I almost feel sorry for Summers, because look, if people have never, Summers is a weird guy. He has a very strange, he talks in a really weird way, as if his jaw is like locked, right? There's something odd about it. And he's a little, I mean, he either doesn't read the room or is really emphatic about not giving a shit. That's why he got fired from Harvard. He didn't have enough political sensibility. I mean, as president of Harvard years ago, to stay out of hot water. So you wouldn't imagine him being a natural with women. And it's kind of sad that he's got to see at his age, get this micro coaching. It's pathetic. But the other thing I'd say is, at least if it's me, if I were seeking that kind of guidance, it would mean I knew that person pretty damn well. And if you knew Jeffrey Epstein pretty damn well, you'd have to be pretty fucking obtuse not to know that he's a guy you shouldn't be hanging out with. You know what I mean? I mean, a number of people have said, I saw right away, creepy guy. I mean, Sam Harris said that. Eric Weinstein said that. Now, granted, I have in the past expressed reservations about both of their judgments, but they're smart guys. They said that. I think Steve Pinker said something.
Pinker's in the data dump of a letter about Epstein to somebody else where he says, you know, this guy's just a pretentious bullshit asshole.
Oh, really?
And I keep, you can find it on Twitter. And he says,
that's good.
I'm into this guy at Harvard because my friends think he's smart. And then he said that he has heard that Epstein now hates Pinker because Pinker doesn't like Epstein and all that. But no, Pinker saw him out as a bullshit artist from the very beginning.
So I don't know. I would say it makes plausible deniability for Summers harder. It's like you seem to have had a very close relationship with this guy. Oh, either that or you are super pathetic because you're walking around getting dating tips from guys you don't know well.
Or Epstein has extraordinary resources that Summers wants a piece of. And so he tries to ingratiate himself with him. And one way you ingratiate yourself with him is say, Bob, hey, you're the expert on this. Could you give me some advice and help me out?
Yeah, I don't think you got to go that far if you're Larry Summers and want to ingratiate yourself to Epstein. I mean, first of all, I think Epstein is a pretty transactional guy. You know, he just probably wanted shit. And anyway, that's my initial take. Who knows? It's not a capital crime.
It's embarrassing. He said some things in the things which were offensive and the emails which were offensive and everything. But I just think, a perfectly legitimate response would be, this is my personal private correspondence. Fuck off. It's not politics. This is not me giving advice. The advice that he's doing the right thing. I'm so sorry. I'm repentant and everything, but I don't know.
I mean, the other thing is like, look, the guy had been indicted. Now you can say, in the end, they made the indictment. I mean, he'd been convicted. He had done prison time.
He did his time. Aren't we supposed to, after somebody has done their time, welcome them back into society?
No, we're not. A legal matter, yes, we're supposed to restore their rights and they can have a job and they can vote. But if you've got good judgment, I would say that if I find somebody, who's been convicted of rape and murder, I am going to make the decision not to hang out with them. I wish them well. I hope that they find a way to redeem themselves. I'm personally not going to take the risk that is obviously there that they haven't.
Yeah. You know, I was nearly at a party with Epstein. Brockman had a big party. And
Brockman, your literary agent.
And some of my friends were there. And Epstein came down. It was in Connecticut. And they came. I was in Europe. If I was in Connecticut where I live and not in Europe, I'd say, I'd love to go to the party. Mm-hmm. And if I knew Epstein was going to be there, yeah, I don't care. I mean, he's like a really awful guy. But I wouldn't have the sort of close friendship with an awful guy. Seeing him at a party, sure. If there's a party, I think Steve Bannon.
You wouldn't get dating tips from him then.
No, I don't. I'm kind of beyond the level of dating tips. I'm gonna go with what I am. Put my back on the market. But I think Steve Bannon's an awful guy. If I was told there's a party and Steve Bannon is going to be there, it'd make me want to go there more than not.
Uh-huh.
I mean, because I think, you know, sometimes awful people are interesting.
I think Bannon is significantly less creepy than Jeffrey Epstein. Talking about what you would have known about him at that time, convicted of whatever it was.
Although in the consequences of his action, I think Bannon is worse.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would agree there, but I mean, Bannon at least has an actual ideology. I in a way I respect him more. He actually does, that's what I would say.
Is that a callback to
nihilistic. Like,
is that a callback to The Big Lebowski?
What?
You've seen The Big Lebowski?
I forget what's the line you were thinking of?
John Goodman, the Lebowski says, you know, those guys, you know, they're Nazis, they're fascists, and Goodman says they're worse. Say what you will about the tenets of National Socialism, at least they have an ethos. These guys are nihilists.
Yeah, I wouldn't say what I said about Bannon about Hitler, but I would say it about Bannon.
Yeah.
Anyway, stay tuned. We'll see. I think there will be a lot of redaction now. Maybe where are we? We're 30 minutes in. Before long, we're going to move into overtime, I think.
Here's a topic. I don't know whether you want to talk about it or not, but I've been very interested in, do you have a connection with Isaac Chotiner?
Chotiner. He actually, do you remember Blogging Hits TV?
I seem to remember, did he once work with you?
He was the first person who ever worked for me. It wasn't full time, it was part time. Yeah, he worked for me 19 years ago. Blogging Hits was started, we just celebrated our 20th anniversary. It was a wild affair. Larry Summers was there. It was amazing.
There's your Epstein connection.
Yeah. No, we didn't. But, yeah, I know Isaac, yeah.
So he has, I don't know if you follow this, but he does interviews for The New Yorker. And apparently for a lot of them, they're just normal interviews. But the ones that everybody talks about are where he utterly savages and humiliates the people he's interviewing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the most recent one was with Joe Biden's press secretary, who comes off as entirely incoherent.
Now, is this the, which one? Is this the, there were several. This is the final one? What's her name? Yeah. It's a woman, right?
It was Jean-Pierre, Karine Jean-Pierre.
Okay.
And I read it, and it's awful. It's basically she's entirely incoherent. Like she's furious about that they kicked Biden out, and then but is unable to defend why she's angry. She says, she's very angry that that people tried to replace Harris, but then she herself says she never thought Harris would win. And mm-hmm. when pressed on this, she harumphs and accuses him, and so.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not isolated. He was, I think, really got Cass Sunstein twisted up. I've seen him I've read other interviews. So anyway, apparently, if he ever invites you to be interviewed, you have to say no, even if you're promoting your book.
He has interviewed me, but not for the New Yorker. He had a podcast at Slate, and when my Buddhism book came out, I was on
his
show.
How did that go?
Went fine. That was before he was doing Mike Wallace imitations as an interviewer. I mean, people used to ask the same thing about Mike Wallace. Like, why do people agree to be interviewed on Mike Wallace? You know, he was on 60 Minutes. He's Chris Wallace's father. And like, he would just like ruin people's lives.
Yeah.
It was like ambush after ambush. And people ask the same thing about Isaac. I think part of the answer is what you just said. I gather there are a lot of interviews that come out better for the person. And, you know, most of us think like, hey, we're okay. It's like, you know, the bad interviews happen to the bad people who have real vulnerabilities. Yeah. But we're like good people and we're smart and, you know, it'll be fine. Guess again.
Yeah. He said he was interviewed. I read a little interview with him and he was asked that question. Why do people agree to be interviewed by you? And first he says, many people have never heard of me. Like they're just doing a book tour and they don't follow the fact that some interviews go badly. And then he says that sometimes he interviews people he's simply interested in their topic. So it's like somebody who you know, he wants to learn about Yemen and have an interview with Yemen. So we'll interview a Yemen expert. But if you're like, I don't know, Cass Sunstein or Alan Dershowitz or whoever, then he just comes in prepared to savage you. So I don't know. Not fond of it.
I don't know. What I want to know is why don't they turn it into a podcast? Who was I talking about this with? I think on a podcast. I was asking, I mean, I'd like to hear the full audio conversation.
You wonder whether they're selective editing. These are long interviews.
Yeah, but people don't often complain about that, do they? I mean, I haven't heard of a lot of controversies where they claim it was dishonestly edited.
No, that's true. That's true.
So, I don't know. But ambushes are great. They're great to read.
I was reading or listening to Derek Thompson, a very smart guy. And he has this discussion called Everything is Television, where he talks about the reduction of everything to short video clips. Mm-hmm. And his mm-hmm. claim is, so for me, I think about podcasts, what you and I are doing now is great because you can listen to it while going for a walk or, you know, doing the dishes and so on. But Thompson claims that video podcasts are growing at a far greater rate than audio ones, the ones mm-hmm. on YouTube. And so what do you think of that? Like, who would want to watch two people talk?
I have the answer to that question. I didn't have the answer to that question. First of all, virtually all of these video podcasts also have audio versions.
So you can listen to Joe Rogan. But apparently a lot of people watch Joe Rogan.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, I don't know why, but I know why people put the videos up. But I'll save that till overtime. Remind me to.
Really?
This is a secret. This is like a podcasting secret.
Podcast secret. Okay. Okay. I'm going to ask you about this in overtime.
Yeah. This is. You know, people got to pay for this. I'm sorry. I call me mercenary. Go ahead, Paul. Call me mercenary.
There's so many topics. Do you have any thoughts about the Olivia Nuzzi?
Now, I would like to say a few kind words about myself. Okay, Olivia Nuzzi.
Go ahead. No, let me stop you. Go ahead.
Olivia Nuzzi, N-U-Z-Z-I, Nuzzi? had been in this relationship with Ryan, is it Lizza? L-I-Z-Z-A, whom I always got mixed up with Chris Saliza, because I think they were both at the New Republic for a while. So there's just all these Z's floating around in this
what
particular scandal.
You are right.
Yeah, no, it's confusing. It's like, what? What the hell? Anyway,
you know,
so
I think this is more evidence we're living in a simulation.
Oh, there's so much evidence of that. Yeah. Do I have stories for you? Like, what about the fire alarm in my hotel at 3 a.m. the night before I was taping, you know, I was taping this thing in the morning. Fucking fire alarm at 3 a.m.?
Okay,
give me a break.
Yeah.
That's not a simulation.
Simulation
or
a malevolent god, but not.
That's actually the way I interpreted it. But
okay. So
let
so,
me just say about myself, I would say, when you emailed me and said you were interested in talking about this Olivia Nuzzi thing, I thought, you know, I don't find this that interesting. And I got to say, I think that speaks highly of me. And the fact that you want to talk about this, you know, salacious, you know, gutter level sex scandal is, I'm not sure it's entirely flattering for you, or I'm not sure it reflects well on your character. But look, I don't judge, Paul.
So
all I know is that it reflects well on me that I'm not interested in this. Now take it away.
You preface this by saying there's something nice about yourself, and I was saying, oh, that's really good. But apparently, it's also something nasty about me.
It's all relative. Status is a zero-sum game, Paul.
It doesn't have to be zero-sum with each other. But nonetheless, you know, it's fun. It's true. It's a fair attack, because I often think, like, I got to talk, and I'll talk to Bob. I'm looking forward to it. But at heart, he's not just an intellectual. He's a journalist. And he wants to talk about the issues of the day. Well, I might want to talk about, you know, broader
Olivia
things.
Olivia Nuzzi.
Yeah, I want to talk about broader issues. But now I felt, oh, Bob would like this, because it's gossipy and it's contemporary, connects to politics. And but now you sort of said, no, you've humiliated me for this.
I am above this, but go ahead. Say what you will about this salacious sex scandal.
I don't have anything that. Explain it,
first of all. Not everyone.
To bring people up to speed.
Yeah.
Nuzzi was doing a profile for New York Magazine on RFK Jr. It was later revealed that at the time she was having an inappropriate relationship with him. Which, and this news was broken by Kara Swisher, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And so she lost her job. The nature of an inappropriate relationship is unclear, and how one-sided is unclear. So Nuzzi has a book out now where she makes it clear that they had a sexual relationship together. And then a couple of days ago, her partner, her ex-husband,
Ryan Lizza. I don't know that they were married. When I read the article that you virtually forced me to read, it said that they had been living together in this swanky Georgetown place and were these socialites, and they had a big book contract. They're going to write a book together and so on. And anyway, go ahead.
So Lizza writes the Substack post, which is a marvelous piece of writerly misdirection. It was classic. So it starts by saying, you know, she comes back from a trip and she has a backpack and some papers spill out, some hotel stationery. And he looks at the hotel stationery and it's love letters. And it's love letters to an older man who's a politician, who's running for president, who's like, and so he tells the whole story. And you totally think it's, you know,
it's surprise.
And then at the very end, he reveals, he calls up their agent and he says, I have some big news. Olivia is having an affair with Mark Sanford. And so this is the story of another big time politician that she has had an inappropriate
former governor. For those of you too young to remember, his everlasting contribution to our culture was to make coin the euphemism hiking the Appalachian Trail, because when he was actually down in South America, a married man down in South America, cavorting with a woman who was a journalist, by the way, it seems to be a habit. His press office, when they said, well, wait, where is he? And they were getting suspicious. It's like, oh, no, he's not in South America. It's like, well, where is he? Why doesn't he show up in Washington? They said, he's hiking the Appalachian Trail, which is so perfect because
You can't,
it's like
you can't
the most remote place in America.
Trail.
It's like, how do you, you can't even land a helicopter on the, there's no way to get to him if he's on the Appalachian Trail.
And it's also a very American thing to do, hiking the Appalachian Trail.
I've done it. Not the whole trail.
Not the whole thing. But I've been on the Appalachian Trail.
Yeah. So anyway, go ahead. That's
why. So this is just this, there's this media blast. She got a nice profile on the New York Times. She's her book has been excerpted in Vanity Fair. And I, as far as I know, there's no deeper moral in this, but you know, love, romance, betrayal. It's just interesting.
Yeah, it was. It seemed to me almost a little sad that he felt the need to like retaliate for her affairs.
Yeah.
But I can see it. I can see it. And look, what do I know? Anyway, the whole thing, you know, made me feel a little unclean. But I guess if this is the kind of thing I have to do in order to stay on good terms with you and maintain this podcast, whatever, whatever, Paul.
But
now can we return to the kinds of high-minded things I like to talk about? You know, Jeffrey Epstein.
Conspiracy theories of all sorts.
Yeah.
To connect it to Larry Summers, I just think if we could dial up the level a little bit of forgiveness and understanding, I would be in favor of that. I think we are too censorious as a rule.
You're asking me to do that in this case?
I'm asking our species to do that. I'm asking American culture to do that.
Well, you know, I may do it, but we will not find out until overtime. And so that's another edge of your seat thing. Will Bob forgive Larry Summers? I'm typing it down.
I'm writing this down. You're going to tell us about video podcasts.
Forgive Larry Summers. Secrets of great, well, no, secrets of podcasters. Let's not exaggerate here. And then what else? We're going to talk about, last time we talked about whether AI is in a bubble. Relevant news from NVIDIA, from Google, and so on. We're going to talk about this show a little bit, just a little bit, because I've only seen the first one. You've seen the first three. Pluribus.
Yep.
Looks like a good show.
Yep, very good show.
Sci-fi thing done by the guy who did Breaking Bad, Vince Gilligan.
Vince Gilligan is great. Yeah.
And you want to talk about the great feminization and Helen Andrews, by the way, hidden in that, there's a story in the Helen Andrews thing that you don't, that's her name, right? That you don't know about, but there's a jilted boyfriend retaliation story that she was part of that is actually weirder significantly than the Ryan Lizzo one. There's so many reasons for people to become paid subscribers, either to my newsletter, the Non-Zero newsletter, or your newsletter, so that they can enjoy the overtime session. You know, how do they resist? Is there anyone who's not going to do this? I don't get it. You know? Paul?
Yeah.
Paul?
I'm just trying to think. I'm trying to sum this up. I want to get some sort of not closure, but some connection, some overall theme. And I want to push the forgiveness angle, which is that I think for all of us, maybe not you, but for all of us, things taken out of private correspondence, private conversations, often we're not at our best. Often we're purposely not at our best with people who we're friends with, who we're acquaintances with, when we're drunk. And I just think you don't judge people on that. There's something like I feel like I'm responding to the Stasi, the secret police, which tapes everything and uses this to humiliate and blackmail people. I just think we should tone that down a bit. So free Larry Summers.
Actually, I have things to say about that. Let's do visit them. Because, you know, while in Doha, after I taped my thing, I went to a taping of another thing that they were doing in the Doha debates, which was a debate on free will, where I had to be in the same room with a compatibilist, but it happens. Anyway, he was on stage. I wasn't. What?
Who was the compatibilist?
He was a philosopher at the, you know, in Doha, there's this thing called University City where they have, you know, versions of several American universities have kind of small campuses on Doha. So there's Georgetown. This guy was at Georgetown and he was at the Doha version of Georgetown campus. And Northwestern, Cornell, what else? Texas A&M. Anyway.
NYU? Is there an NYU there?
You would think, because NYU does a lot of this, but I'm not sure whether whether there is. Yeah. It is there. So,
you know, Bob, I'm kind of a compatibilist myself.
I know. I mean, I'm happy to argue with that. I think I've gotten irate about compatibilism in your question, in your presence. And I'm happy to do it again. So, yeah, let me write that down.
Behind the paywall.
So we'll solve the free will problem after I do Secrets of Podcasting. And no, but that's relevant to blame, to the apportionment of blame. I do want to talk about that part. That's what's relevant to Larry Summers. Apportionment of blame. Okay, so we're going into overtime. Thanks, okay, to everybody, whether you're going or not. But we personally think you should go. Paul and I think you should go. Yeah, it's going to be fun.
It's free will. But decide on your own.
Yeah. And smash the like button in any event.
Smash that like button. Yes. Yes. Rate us and review us on your rate favorite review podcast platform.
Or app. Yeah. Or both. Okay. Okay.